Okay. I'm going to lead with the restoration of diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And this is significant because both countries are important Middle Eastern powers. Iran is a big country. Not least in terms of its oil and population. And Saudi Arabia has got a much smaller population, but of course is the world's either top or second top oil exporter. I'm not sure exactly what the statistics are at the moment. Either way, what is also significant, of course, about this restoration of diplomatic relations is that this was a deal brokered by China. And I think quite rightly, various commentators are making the point that this is the product of a rising China and a declining US hegemon. Of course, if we look at things in the Middle East, it would be very hard, if impossible, surely. To see the United States playing the role of some sort of intermediary between the House of Saud and the theocratic regime in Tehran, simply because, yes, Saudi Arabia is a long-time ally, but the point would be that Iran is a long-time enemy, and that cannot be said in terms of China. China isn't an enemy. Either of Saudi Arabia or Iran. Okay, so this deal apparently was brokered by Wang Yi. He's not the foreign minister in Beijing. He's what is described as the most important diplomat. Either way, he's a top bod in Chinese foreign policy. He was the guy that was trying to broker a deal in Ukraine between Russia and Ukraine, if you recall, just a few weeks back. Okay, that's just a little tiny bit of background. Diplomatic relations were severed in 2016. This is mainly from my memory. And this was to do with an outbreak of discontent in the east of Saudi Arabia amongst the Shia minority in the country. And as a result of this outbreak of discontent, the Saudi authorities executed a Shia mullah. And as a result of that, what we saw is big protests. And I can't remember, was the Chinese embassy, not Chinese embassy, the Saudi embassy in Tehran attacked? I can't remember, but it was that sort of type incident that led to the severing of diplomatic relations. And what we've had over the years is a sort of low-level war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And that's taken the form of a proxy war, which you could describe it as, at least to a degree. Obviously, it's a lot more complex than that. But nonetheless, I think a proxy war has been fought out between those two countries in Syria. And you could also make the argument, I think, again, quite legitimately, that a sort of proxy war has been fought in the Yemen. Meanwhile, we've had shipping attacked. We've had all sorts of operations of, electronic warfare being launched, all sorts of low level operations in terms of attacks on one side or the other. So, what exactly happens as a result of this rapprochement, I don't know. It could have some unexpected consequences. I don't think that we're on the sort of edge of, you know, peace and light and all that breaking out in the Middle East, thanks to the benign role of China. Nonetheless, I would expect at least some sort of moves to follow in Syria, and I would expect some sort of moves to follow in the Yemen. I could be wrong, but that's what I would expect. I think as well as framing this rapprochement in the light of rising China and declining the United States, and just to add that because the United States is in decline, I don't think that's inexorable. I don't think that China overtaking the United States is inevitable in the same way that if you looked at world politics in 1900, I wouldn't make the argument that a declining Britain was inevitably going to be overtaken by a rising Germany. Okay, so as I say, as well as putting this rapprochement in the context of, you know, great power politics, I think we also need to put it in the context of regional politics. And I think what we've had since at least the emergence of Mohammed bin Salman as the primary personality in Saudi Arabia. Remember, he's not yet king, he's heir apparent, but he is the main political operator in Saudi Arabia. What we've had with him has been quite interesting, and that's a willingness to openly defy the United States. And clearly, the most famous example of that was the dismembering, the killing and dismembering of the Saudi dissident Khashoggi, got it just about right, in, that was in Istanbul. No, it wasn't. It was in Ankara that happened. Either way, the United States promised swift punishment, and basically MBS faced them down. America threatened consequences, but at least so far, I cannot detect any consequences that have come upon MBS in particular, or Saudi Arabia. I mean, I was expecting myself the United States to switch off, for example, high-level intelligence of plots to assassinate one MBS, because he's highly unpopular in royal circles and elite circles in Saudi Arabia. Remember when he locked up, I don't know how many people, but, you know, hundreds of relatives and relations and rich people in, was it the Hilton Hotel? And basically demanded that they hand over millions and millions in terms of ill-gotten gains to the royal treasury. So what we're dealing with here isn't just China, isn't just the United States. We're also dealing, I think, with a much more assertive Saudi Arabia. Now, how realistic MBS's plans are, whether he's going to be soon suffering from hubris, I don't know. I mean, all I know about Saudi Arabia is that historically it's relied on British support and now crucially on American support just to survive. This isn't, in spite of propaganda to the contrary, you know, a deeply loved regime. It's a regime that owes much more to outside power than it does internal power. I could be wrong now, maybe things have changed, but somehow I doubt it. Somehow I don't think that the Saudi army, air force, navy, the bureaucracy, I don't view them as reliable. I don't view other members of the royal family as reliable when it comes to the present monarch and his heir apparent. But I think that is also a factor, i.e. Saudi Arabia is prepared to act without the United States. Now, how the United States is going to respond to this Chinese brokered rapprochement, again, I haven't got a clue. It could be, well, that's good from their point of view, peace in the Middle East. Well, we want that because we're in the middle of the conflict in Ukraine. We don't want to be fighting on two fronts. So anything that brings peace in the Middle East is good. On the other hand, they might be furious at this upstart MBS getting too big for his shoes. And maybe they will soften to the agitation coming from Jerusalem, from the Netanyahu government, that something must be done in terms of Iran's nuclear program, and we will do it. We all know the story of the, is it 84%? Uranium enrichment. I think you need 90% for a weapons grade bomb. In other words, if we look at Iran, it's on the edge of nuclear weapon capability. Now, whether it could deliver such a bomb, I don't know. On the other hand, we do know about the relations between North Korea and Iran, and we do know that in terms of North Korea, at least, it's got some capable missiles, and I cannot see any reason in principle why Iran couldn't avail itself of that technology. Or, for that matter, one country we do know has got plenty of missiles, maybe it's in need of them, but certainly when it comes to technology, there's Russia. And that is more than capable and has been more than capable since at least the launch of Sputnik. Was that 1960? I can't quite remember. I'd have been very young, but I do remember that going round the world, sending out its message, which wasn't just bleep, 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 bleep. It was, we can send a missile onto New York, Washington, Chicago, anywhere. In the United States. So the United States was vulnerable to a serious attack for the first time. Okay. We also, of course, have the situation for Netanyahu, that he's got a majority government, but only just. And at the moment, what we have is mass demonstrations in Israeli cities over basically of the authoritarian tendencies of that government, the attempt to clamp down on the courts, which would serve Netanyahu well, given that he keeps out of jail because he's prime minister. So, you know, there is a court case going for him over corruption. As prime minister, he cannot be done. And if he reads Machiavelli, as I'm sure he does, he will know that foreign adventures are a very good way of dealing with domestic discontent. So start a war with Iran, blame Iran for starting it. That's easily done. And then get the Americans in on your side. We're not talking, I hasten to add, about some invasion. That isn't going to happen with a country like Iran. But clearly what's afoot is not only the attempt to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age when it comes to its nuclear program. What we've got clearly in terms of an American agenda is regime change from above. And at present, their preferred candidate, which is amazing, is the former Shah's son, who's promising democracy, free trade unions, human rights, you name it, and the idea that anyone in Iran will trust such an individual, I find impossible to take seriously. Indeed, what you've got in terms of demonstrations in Iran are slogans, down with the theocracy, down with the supreme leader, but also down with Pahlavi. And that's clear. Okay, moving on. Sunak, Braverman, and small boats. apparently Britain is being invaded by a fleet of small boats who are offloading foreign alien elements onto our shores. And so what we have in Parliament is the illegal migration bill. Now, I'm sure it will be delayed by the House of Lords. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the department that's responsible for it is the Subrahmanyam's Home Office. And it actually says, it makes it absolutely clear that this legislation, well, most likely will fall before the courts. So it actually, from their own paper, they actually say it's got less than a 50% chance of standing up to scrutiny before judges. That tells you something. So in other words, there's your civil servants. This is what you tell them to draft. They draft it, but they tell you that, look, we think a Home Secretary, that this probably is not just pushing the envelope of existing law, it's probably pushing the envelope of existing law to the point where it will be rejected. So what's the point of pushing through a piece of legislation through the House of Commons, through the House of Lords? What's the point of getting it to King Charles to give it his royal assent when you know, or you think you know, or you probably know that it's going to be rejected when it comes to appeals and it works its way up through the court system? We'll come to that in a minute. Okay, but what does this illegal migration bill promise? Basically, draconian measures that if you come to Britain illegally, you'll never be a citizen. We will deport you. We will lock you up. We're going to do all sorts of horrible things to you. So stop coming here. That's basically the promise. And so instead of having, hotels of where people have to stay, what they have is detention camps. And we've got some RAF, former RAF camp already being pinpointed for such purposes. But then you come to the big question, you know, the 100,000. No, I don't think it's £100,000 question. It's more the £500 million question, isn't it? And that's, where do you send people back to? Well, France has made it clear, if it needed to be made clear, well, we're not having them back. Merely because people came from Calais doesn't give Britain the right to take them over the other side of the channel and dump them in Calais. Other European countries, just because these people traveled through Europe and maybe they entered the EU through Bulgaria or Greece or wherever it happens to be, they're not going to have these people back. And then you start looking at what sort of countries people are coming from, and you say, well, Afghanistan, now that would go down well. You're going to transport people back to Kabul Airport. What about Syria? What about Iraq? What about Iran? Okay, I can imagine it working when it comes to Albania. But most countries, it just doesn't work, because when it comes to most countries, most people are fleeing because of social breakdown. And just to add a point, which I think is worthwhile adding, that what we're dealing with here is not the most desperate of people. What we're dealing with is people who can be included, at least back home, those that would be considered middle class. After all, if we look at the cost of coming over in a small boat from France, what is it? It's about £7,000, £8,000, £10,000. And you either have to pay that straight away, i.e. some arrangement with banks when you land before you set sail, or afterwards. And there'll be ways of getting the family to ensure that money is paid. That's how the business model works. Either way, the point that I would make is that what we're dealing with here, in the main, in the overwhelming majority of cases, are migrants, economic migrants. And what the left has it as is we're dealing with refugees, people fleeing political persecution. I've got no hesitation in saying that the vast majority of Albanians, and they make up a big slice of the present, numbers that we're dealing with in terms of small boats, vast majority of them are not fleeing political persecution. They are simply looking for a better life. And as a result of that, I think the statistics are in Albania is something like 50% of the population between 15 and 25 have gone abroad. Now, some of them would have gone to Italy, some would have gone to Germany, but a lot will be going to Britain. And why Britain? Well, as they will explain to a BBC reporter, the reason I'm going to Britain is because I speak some English, right? I don't speak German, I don't speak French, I don't speak Italian. And also uncle, aunt, brother, friend is in London, Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham. And of course, you know, coming to a foreign country, having that sort of support is a huge advantage. Rather than going to a country where you don't know anyone at all. And it's no surprise, of course, that we get reports of where people are free to move, i.e. they're in a hotel, they abscond. Why on earth wouldn't they? And we have this big thing about 15, 16-year-olds, children, leaving these places. And of course, they get involved in the black economy. No doubt some of them get involved in crime. But given the fact that they're not allowed to work legally, that is surely no surprise. And someone wanting to leave a hotel in order to meet their friends, in order to get some money together, in order to go back maybe to build a house or to be a big man in the village, why on earth not? Anyway, my main point still is that this attempt by the Tory government to break the so-called business model I find completely uncredible. One, I don't think, while it might get through Parliament, I don't think it will get through the courts. And even if it gets through the courts, how practical is it? After all, what we've had already is the Tory government spending £140 million in terms of Rwanda. What's the result? Lots of court cases. Not one person has been deported to Rwanda. Can one seriously envisage tens of thousands of people being deported to Uganda? I don't find that credible. And indeed, we need to understand why the small boats. Well, because the previous model, maybe less organized model of smuggling yourself over on a ferry, smuggling yourself over inside a lorry, that model was broken by putting in sniffer dogs, by putting in heat detectors, by putting in cameras over the channel crossing, etc., etc. And one thing I would suggest, if the small boats model is blocked off because of the British government spending £500 million over 3 years vis-a-vis the French government, some other model will be found. So instead of going from France, from the short hop over the channel, go some other route. I am not able to say the North Sea, the Irish Sea. Either way, people are desperate to have a better life and they will search it out, whatever governments say, and whatever threats governments make. Okay. Yeah, of course, the model is Australia. And what Australia did is a sort of Rwanda deal, except not with a country far away. They did a deal with Papua New Guinea and Nauru. I'm not quite sure about Nauru, what exactly. I presume it's an island, a state somewhere in the Australian Pacific. Either way, people have been detained in camps in New Guinea for years and years and years. And all I would say is I cannot see that working in Britain, because we're not dealing with the sort of sea crossing that you have with Australia. We're not dealing with Australian type conditions. We're dealing with European conditions. Okay. Right. Yeah, just a few points. I mentioned the whole question of refugees. Of course there are refugees. The basic advice is that if you're coming from Albania, declare yourself a refugee. If you declare yourself an economic migrant, you'll be rejected stage one and shown where the airport is, and basically taken back to Tirana. So people are being told what the line is, and basically what we've got is a situation in terms of the left is it plays along with the idea of refugees. Refugees are meant to be deserving. Economic migrants are meant to be undeserving. I reject that completely. In my view, people ought to have the right to live anywhere on the planet that they want to. They should be able to go to any country that they want to. But of course, we don't just finish by saying that. What we say is, if you take the richer countries, well, what we need is full trade union rights. We need full legal rights. And the reality of countries like Britain, Germany, the United States, is that migrants will come, economic migrants will come. And the question is, do you have legal status as a migrant coming in to a country, or do you have illegal status? If you have illegal status, that opens up workers to super exploitation by bosses. It opens them up to being exploited by criminal gangs. And it's also a way of undermining the wages of the bottom end of the working class. I'm not saying it's only the bottom end, but in particular, the bottom end of the working class. So building sites, you know, cleaning, these sort of operations. If you're in competition with an illegal worker, the chances are they will be being paid worse. They will be doing more hours. And the boss, if they get bolshy, can threaten, if you get like this, I will call the police on you and get you deported. And so what we want is a situation where the British Labour Movement organises these people into trade unions. We integrate people into British politics in order to limit competition between workers. That is a fundamental principle of the political economy of the working class that is born within capitalism, but goes against the grain of capitalism, that ends in the overthrow of capitalism. We are not out to preserve the position of the working class in Britain by limiting competition, by keeping workers out, i.e. with so-called non-racist immigration controls. What are racist immigration controls? What are non-racist immigration controls? Does that keep Poles out? Does that keep Albanians out? Does it only let Africans in? This is a nonsense. No, what we stand for is free movement, but organizing labor in Britain, but also internationally. But first of all, to limit competition, but then to organize against the existence of capital itself. Okay. Right. Oh, last point on this. Rishi Sunak, there he is on the number 10 lectern. Keep the small boats out. This is the opening shots of, I would guess, the 2024 general election. This is what the Tories will fight the general election on, and they will accuse Labour of being soft. Labour will say that this legislation won't work, it will be rejected by the courts, which gives the Tories an incentive to spin it out as long as they can. This is their weapon against Labour. What's Labour's alternative? Well, we want to stop small boats as well, but we would do it properly. How? How would you do it? I don't know of any credible measures that they would take. They're not going to declare themselves in favour of free movement and the influx of Labour from abroad. Labour Party is not going to do that. It is a national chauvinist party. Of course, it will attempt to compete with the Tories, but the Tories will always outcompete them on such issues. Who can be the nastiest to foreigners? I think the Tory party has a good record on that. The Labour Party has a dreadful record, but the Tories have a worse record. Going back to their very origins in 16 something or other, when the Tories organised popular resistance to Huguenots, French Protestants coming to Britain, who were undermining British labourers and skilled artisans and all the rest of it. Keep the Huguenots out. And of course, it's not just been Huguenots, it's been the Irish, it's been Jews, it's been Kenya, Asians, you name it. That's the Tory party for you. Which neatly brings me, of course, to Gary Lineker. And you all know Gary Lineker, match of the day, former England football captain. He's been on Twitter. I don't follow Gary on Twitter, I'm afraid to say. I'm one of the few people. I don't know how many followers he's got. I'm sure it's millions. He tweeted in response to Suella Braverman and the Sunak small boats legislation that I won't get the exact words, but this is reminiscent of the language that was used in Germany in the 30s. I think I've sort of got the basic gist of it. To me, he's a typical English person, British maybe, because our sort of standard myth nowadays is World War II, and apparently World War II was fought in order to smash anti-Semitism and overthrow the evil of racism as represented by the Nazis. It had nothing to do with defending the British Empire and preserving Britain's rule over, I think at the time, was it 350, 400 million Indians in the British Indian Empire? Nothing to do with that, of course. It's all about Germany and the Nazis. So naturally, as a typical English person, typical British person, Gary talked about Germany. Actually, a better comparison, Gary, would be the language of the Tories in the 30s. Because if you think about the 30s, what you had, certainly once the Nazis came to power, 1933, is restrictions on Jews, threats against Jews, and anyone who had the ability to get out would get out. So you saw the exodus, not only of scientists, artists, political activists, big businessmen, bankers, but also right down into the petty bourgeoisie. Anyone who could get out would be trying to get out. And of course, what was going on as Germany was clamping down legally on the position of Jews, demonizing Jews, is that one country after another were putting up higher and higher barriers against Jewish immigration into their countries. And that included the United States, but it also included Britain. And if we look at Britain, look at the language of the Daily Mail, the language of invasion, the language of filth. And that language was pointed at Jews coming to Britain. Of course, there was a history before that, of Jews escaping from the pogroms of Poland and the Russian Empire, but the new influx was in the 30s. And yeah, the language was eerily familiar. We're not talking about the Holocaust. We're not talking about mass extermination. We're talking about the language of talking about people invading by moving from one country to another when they've got no weapons, no tanks, no aircraft. They barely got anything more than the clothes that they actually stand up with. That's the sort of invasion that Suella Braverman is talking about. And that is reminiscent of the sort of treatment of Jews in the 30s who were, yes, stripped of money, artworks, anything of value by the German authorities, and therefore did tend to go abroad penniless unless they had well-connected relatives. Anyway, I'm not out to correct Gary Lineker. I'm just saying that this is the sort of response that we know that British people, you know, who are fair-minded, liberal, mainstream persuasion will respond to language such as is coming out of the mouths of Sunak and Suella Braverman. And of course, it wasn't just, looking back to the 30s, it wasn't just the Daily Mail, who also ran a headline famously, "Hurrah for the Black Shirts." This is Oswald Mosley's Black Shirts. It was the Times, it was mainstream Tory politicians, and it was our lovely, lovely royal family. Everyone should look at the photograph of Her Late Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II, stiff arm salute, along with her sister and her aunt and her uncle. And that was a general sentiment amongst the aristocracy in Britain in the 1930s. Okay. So what have we had? We've had the announcement that Gary Lineker is stepping back from his role as a presenter. This is a BBC announcement about his role on Match of the Day. Well, in other words, he's been pushed. He's not stepped. He's refused to step back and denounce his tweet. He's standing by his words. Good luck to him. And what has been encouraging, what's been pleasing, is the swell, the groundswell of support for him. We recognize exactly who he is. He's not left-wing. He's not progressive in any left-wing sense. He's someone who I think said Ben Corbyn, for example. That tweet or whatever he expressed that, that of course is not controversial. That is not impartial, is it? That sort of tweet is perfectly acceptable, but to finger the Tories, that is unacceptable for the BBC at the present time. And so what we've seen is a rebellion. And what we've had is Ian Wright, former Arsenal player, Alan Shearer, again, another former England captain, Newcastle United, saying that we're not going to appear on Match of the Day as pundits. And also what we've had is a load of footballers, and I don't know where they're from, saying that they wouldn't appear either. So that's been a tremendous thing to see. And it's not just the usual suspects. This is quite an interesting aspect to the story. So we've got Greg Dyke, former top BBC bod. We've got Piers Morgan, right-wing commentator, saying, well, you've done well, Gary. Jeremy Clarkson, right-wing commentator, also siding with Gary Lineker. And inevitably, what we've got is the right-wing media, Tories, that are saying Gary Lineker should be ashamed of himself for such language. And I've had it that Sue Braverman, I mean, after all, she's married to a Jewish person. Her children are relatives of people who suffered in the Holocaust. How dare Gary Lineker make such a suggestion? Well, Gary Lineker is quite right making that suggestion. It's not that such language inevitably leads to the Holocaust. That's not the case. But it does lead to dehumanizing people. And we disapprove thoroughly of the legislation and that approach to fellow human beings who are, after all, only out to get better conditions for themselves. And also, of course, what we have at the present time, I think, is a situation in Britain amongst the establishment of where there is a feeling that the Tories are in their last days. I'm not talking about the Tory party, I'm talking about the Tory government. Most people are expecting a Tory defeat in 2024. Now, we could be wrong and maybe keep the immigrants out, keep the small boats out. Maybe that works. I don't know. But it does seem to me that people are getting courage at the present time to speak out against the Tories, because what they're actually backing is Keir Starmer. What Keir Starmer will actually do in government, I don't know. The rhetoric, no doubt, will be different. Will the reality be any different? Will the Labour Party close detention camps? Will the Labour Party allow people to move into Britain? Rhetorically, I doubt it. Anyway, just a last point on all of that. We've, of course, got a BBC chair who's very vulnerable at the present time, and a BBC director who's very vulnerable, both brought in by the Tories to oversee impartiality. This guy, of course, Richard Sharp, he's the guy that facilitated an £800,000 loan to the former prime minister, who gave him the job of BBC chair. Meanwhile, we've had on the BBC other impartial types, such as Andrew Neil, Michael Portillo, Alan Sugar, who, of course, never tweet their political views, do they? You know, what's their view of Corbyn? What's their view of the general election? What's their view about politics? Of course they do. It's absurd to think anything else. Okay, strikes. We've got junior doctors joining the strike wave, 61,000 of them. I think they make up a very high proportion of doctors in hospitals. So these are people who are not consultants. They're the people you almost certainly see if you go into A&E after your 4-hour wait. You'll see a junior doctor. They are going on strike. And again, this is just a statistic I've lifted from the BMA. Since 2008-29, their pay has gone down in real terms by 26%. In other words, a quarter. And of course, a lot of that decline would be recent because of the surge in inflation that we've seen over the last year. So they are going on strike over pay, but they're also going on strike over conditions. We all know that the conditions for junior doctors historically in Britain have been appalling. I know we now are meant to have legal limits to hours. How that's actually enforced, I don't know. There was a very good, I think it was a BBC series with Ben Whishaw playing the lead role. I think it was called This Will Hurt. If comrades haven't seen it, please do. It was a wonderful description of the chaos and the heroism that there is in the NHS. Either way, what we have is a situation where we might get as a result of the budget, is a situation of where the cap on the number of doctors and the number of nurses and the number of midwives that the government is prepared to pay for is actually reduced down. They have a promise to actually increase numbers. But what Britain has done historically is rely on poaching cheap labour, trained labour from South Africa, Africa, you know, Rwanda, Philippines, you name it. So you get skilled people in Britain, but you don't have to pay for the training. I know that works two ways. Either way, they're joining the strike wave, and that's absolutely brilliant. And according to Socialist Worker, and I'm sure they're right, this budget day, March the 15th, will see the biggest number of workers on strike since I don't know when. 500,000 workers are due to be out on strike. Sure, these are short strikes, and it's jolly good that some trade unions have coordinated their action. So amongst those that are coming out, our college and university lecturers, the UCU union, whose union leadership has caved in and then been forced by pressure from below to come out on the 15th, they'll be out, and there'll be various sections of the rail service on strike, various other sections of workers. But what there won't be is RCN, workers, Royal College of Nursing, Unison workers on ambulance, and Unite workers. Unite workers, much smaller section of ambulance workers. They won't be out because their trade union leaders are in negotiations over a new government offer. And the sort of offer that the government is giving and the sort of level that trade union officials are accepting can be seen from the FBU, the Fire Brigades Union, led by Matt Rack, left-wing Matt Rack, former member of Militant. He's recommended, and I think they've got the vote, he's certainly recommending it, a 9% settlement over 2 years. That's a pay cut, Matt. That's a pay cut. And what we've had in other unions is similar levels of either a non-recommendation or a recommendation of acceptance. It wouldn't surprise me that given inflation is over 10% still, that rank and file workers reject these sort of deals. But this is what's on offer, you know, 7%, 9%. And we're not just talking about, as I said, 1 year. Sometimes this is over a number of years. But certainly what, you know, in terms of the picture that we're seeing a fraying that's going on. And that is accurately reported in this week's Socialist Worker, is not reported at all in this week's edition of The Socialist. That is something you should expect. We are talking about sectional struggles. And trade union bureaucrats are in the job of trading labour power and getting the best price and the best condition for labour power. But they are merchants. They haven't got the political strategy or discipline to go for a coordinated action and have a class-wide view or a political view. And indeed, what is characteristic of the present time is very much a syndicalistic approach. We don't need politics. That is a big mistake. And I think we're seeing that particular scenario play itself out at the present time. I think strikes and struggles, of course, will continue simply because workers have no choice in the question. But the coordination and the, how should I put it, the initial flush of enthusiasm, I think has will reach a peak, at least a momentary peak, on March the 15th budget day. Okay, lastly, this is the this isn't the Gary Lineker bit, but this is the censorship bit of my sort of weekly worker advert. This is about the statement that the Provisional Central Committee issued in this week's Weekly Worker, entitled Upholding the Free Speech Principle. Now, this might be viewed as, and I do view it as, a storm in a teacup on one level. You know, we're talking about an obscure, unofficial, not even official, unofficial Weekly Workers readers group on social media. I don't know how many people participate in it. But clearly, we're not talking about tens and tens of thousands of people and decisive sections of the working class. On the other hand, while it might be a storm in a teacup, it involves principle, and principle matters when it comes to politics. Principle is not something one should easily discard. And indeed, one should do the exact opposite. One should stand on principle and fight for principle. Anyway, the long and the short of it is that this unofficial readers group is established on the basis, I might get this wrong in detail, but it'd be right in essence, on the basis of a triple questionnaire. Do you read the Weekly Worker? Yes. What's the most interesting article that you've read in the Weekly Worker this week? Well, it's either Mark Mulholland or Mike McNair. What political tendency are you in? None, or whatever the other answer happens to be. And on that basis, presuming that you sound sort of a reasonable chappy or chappess, you're in. And what we have in terms of Discord as a site, that contains many sites, is some sort of series of stipulations that remind me, certainly, of my experience in Left Unity. They're called safe spaces. And what we have from Discord is you've got to be polite. You mustn't offend anybody on the basis of sex, religion, you name it, I don't know. But you mustn't be nasty to anyone. And the comrades who set up this particular group have clearly been influenced by that ideology. It's the dominant ideology of the liberal bourgeoisie. You'll find it in the Labour Party. You'll find it in the trade union movement. You'll find it being pushed by the US Democrats. You'll just carry on. Left Unity, I've already mentioned. And what they've done is have some sort of code of conduct that begins, you've got to keep it comradely and you must not do X, Y. We disagree with that profoundly as a matter of principle. We say that if you're in a political organizations have the right, just like chess clubs, darts clubs, football clubs, to draw their parameters. This is who's in. These are the membership requirements. You pay £10 a year. If you don't pay £10 a year, you're not a member. But when it comes to politics, the key should be political principles. That should be the key. And what moderators should be doing is, of course, they can intervene when it comes to particular debates to keep things calm, keep things rational. But their job is to facilitate debate, not to kick people out who said something that other people find unacceptable. So what we had is a particular incident. We've already talked about the trans question of where someone said something along the lines of, I don't feel comfortable with what you're saying on this question. After all, we've just had a murder of a young trans woman in Britain, and this isn't something I want to have batted to and fro here. And the comrade in question, my understanding is, and it doesn't really matter in terms of the details, the comrade responded on the basis, would you say that if it was just a woman involved? After all, in Britain today, as I speak, women will be being battered by their partners. The murder of a woman in Britain is so ordinary that it hardly features on the news. You know, it's almost local news. So we have hundreds of murders of women because they are women. Do you then ban a situation of where you have attacks on feminism being ruled out of order because a particular woman says she feels uncomfortable with that because there's just been a murder of a woman? I don't think you would. And even if that person did find the debate uncomfortable, my argument and the argument of this organization is You have to learn to live with it or get out. If you're uncomfortable with the debate, don't participate. This is not something that we want to establish, a safe space for people. No, we object to safe spaces, because these are charters for bureaucrats. And inevitably, what begins with good intentions actually is turned round against awkward political minorities. And we've seen it on a giant scale in Britain over the recent period with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and beyond. And what we've seen is the claim, remember the lobby and the conference in Brighton, and someone who wasn't even Jewish saying, that really makes me uncomfortable. We've seen that safe space attitude turned around to head a giant purge of the left in the Labour Party. We've seen it turn around and drive Jeremy Corbyn out from being leader of the Labour Party. We've seen the Labour left cowed under this campaign. We've seen how this campaign spread out of the Labour Party into the universities. We've seen people sacked from their jobs because they've voiced an opinion, and we're not talking about Gary Lineker here. I could mention Stan Keeble, for example, all on the basis of safe spaces politics. So the Weekly Worker stands for freedom of speech. The CPGB stands for freedom of speech. And if you have someone who's got political views that are unacceptable, such as a real anti-Semite position that was put forward by Ian Donovan, for example, then you handle it politically. And what we have done when we've encountered that precisely, for example, in the Communist Platform of Left Unity, we had a day conference where we debated this question out, all fully reported in the Weekly Worker. We did not have a situation of where some official said that you, Ian Donovan, are barred. We had the situation where the membership barred him on the basis of politics, not on the basis of offence. And just to finish on that, just to quote programme on this, the programme of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, which was agreed by the RSDLP, i.e. the Bolsheviks and Mensheviks, was for unrestricted freedom of speech. Now, that doesn't mean freedom for opportunists, but it does mean freedom of speech for all members, and certainly not a situation where, because Lenin made a joke in bad taste, or Plekhanov made a joke in bad taste, or Martov came out with some unacceptable form, that some official could bar them from the organization. Anyway, that's all.